Let me introduce now our next speaker, who is David Hawkes. Dave Hawkes is a professor at University College London, and he currently is the director of the Center for Medical Image Computing at UCL. He was previously chairman of the Division of Imaging Sciences at KCL, which is King's College London. Dave spent 7 years working as a clinical scientist at St. George Hospital London before returning to academia. He's a co-founder of IXICO, a university spin-out that provides imaging solutions to the pharmaceutical industry. His current research interests encompass image matching, data fusion, visualization, shape representation, surface geometry, and modeling tissue deformation, and also image-guided interventions. So Professor David Hawkes was elected a Fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences, a Fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering. He became a senior investigator of the National Institute for Health Research in 2009.
Thank you very much for that fantastic introduction. And it's great to be here. It's a fantastic day. I've really enjoyed today. And I think a wonderful environment here in the Collège de France. So far, we have to wait and see what you think of mine. An excellent set of presentation. I think a really interesting cross-section of what's going on in medical image computing. So I think my task is to talk a little bit about the image-guided interventional work that we've been doing. And Nicholas put in the multi-scaled word in there. There's a bit more emphasis on this talk on the getting down in scale to the interesting things that go on at the cellular scale in image-guided interventions. Most, not quite all, but most of the applications I'll be talking about are in cancer. So I think this builds quite well on the work that was described by Mike Brady this morning. I need to get a glass of water, excuse me. So like Guido, thank you for letting me have a glass of water, which will stop me from croaking, I hope, while I'm giving my talk. So image-guided interventions, there we go. It's probably been, in the sense that we think of image-guided surgery, is it's been around for about 20 years. And this is a very early case. We were working actually with Philips Medical Systems on their EasyGuide system here. And this is a rather gruesome picture. So I always like showing these after lunch rather than before lunch. But showing using a relatively simple bit of computation, which was, whoops, I didn't mean to do that, taking a rigid body transformation. And I've now lost my cursor. Where's my, there we go. Taking a track pointer here, which has got a bunch of LEDs on it. From that, we can deduce where the tip is. The tip is now right inside that patient, but we've also used that same device to locate markers on the patient's head, which also show up on the images, and doing a simple rigid body transformation, we're able to find exactly where we are. And this is quite a stunning case. That we observed, where Alan Crockard, who's now retired, was a surgeon who was coming through to clip an aneurysm on the vertebral artery there, coming through in a rather gruesome way from the front of the face to approach this aneurysm here in front of the brainstem, where otherwise, without this technology, this would have been an inoperable case. The patient survived the operation and lived to tell the tale, as they say, and without this, I say this would have been inoperable, and eventually the patient would have died because this aneurysm would have ruptured. Another sort of take on this technology that we developed a few years later was an augmented reality system. If I can get the video working, I've lost my cursor again, which is dancing around all over the place. Where's it gone? There we go. So the surgeon is peering through a surgical operating microscope that's been calibrated, and then accurately aligned with that are the 3D models that we've derived from, in this case, MRI, shown in blue, where is the acoustic neuroma that has just been excised, and the surgeon is now checking that the whole of the tumour has been removed. Now, bringing up to the present day, the way the paradigm of image-guided interventions has developed, I like to describe in this way. We have target identification, target usually being the tumour, and that's done through diagnostic imaging, MR, CT, that sort of thing we've heard a lot about today. Then there's a target location, and so that's the guidance part, and there usually has to be some sort of verification. A verification either using a sensing system that's linked with the surgical instrument, or by taking a biopsy, doing some analysis of that biopsy before proceeding with the full ablation or removal of tissue. And then we have the target destruction, which is guiding the surgeon's knife, or in some cases a needle carrying, for example, RF energy or cold through cryoablation or other cytotoxic drugs. And the idea to do that is to do that with minimal collateral damage. Now, what I'll be talking about today is how we're starting to introduce some, I think, very interesting information on tissue microstructure into that paradigm I've just described. Some have called it in vivo histology, and it's the interesting scale, which was certainly in Peter's talk and in other talks. Imaging, we are able to get now very good quality images down to the scale of about a millimeter in vivo, MRCT and so on, maybe a little bit better. But there's interesting things that go on at the micron scale. So this is the cellular structure that we're looking at, and these and how these change during the pathologies, in particular cancer, that we're looking at. So we have changes in the way that the tissue organizes itself, and this, as Mike Brady was talking about, is caused by the changing in the underlying genetic information and how those genes are expressed in the changes of the tissue that we see. So that brings us into the study of genetics and the epigenetics of the tissue that we're looking at. So I'll describe just a little bit how we're getting that information into the image guidance technologies that we're developing. And then the other part of the story is how we can maintain a target accuracy of the order of 1 millimeter, which is seems to be, when we're looking at the ablation, when we're looking at the likely damage or seriousness of disease, 1 millimeter scale does seem about right. Going to a finer scale may not be necessary, but we do need to maintain that target accuracy of about a millimeter. And one of the problems, in particular with cancer, most cancers, as you saw on Mike Brady's slide, talking about the different cancers and the incidence, occur in soft tissues, in the prostate, in the liver, in the bowel, in the breast, and so on. Now, these are sort of large floppy organs that move and distort in significant ways. So the structures are going to be in a very different position, even shape, from when the diagnostic imaging is done. So we've been developing, and it's been quite a struggle to do this. It's been hard work, and it's not just ourselves, many groups around the world, in how we can model that soft tissue deformation and how we can follow structures that move. Everything inside, say, the abdomen is going to be moving with the respiratory cycle. Lungs are inflating and deflating and pushing up and down all the organs within the abdomen. And we want to be able to follow that during the intervention so we can maintain our surgical maps. So I'll be illustrating this with starting with an application in neurosurgery. Talking, this is where the microstructure story comes in, better patient stratification in order to guide focal therapy in the prostate, and also some work that we're now just starting to do on the breast cancer, and the story is certainly not finished there. And then finish up on how we compensate for soft tissue deformation in structures that move regularly with the respiratory cycle. So that will be looking at motion in the liver and the lung. What's interested me, I guess there's probably more MR research than molecular imaging research going on immediately within our lab, is some of the recent MR advances that have some relation to what I'm talking about. So we're starting to see MR able to follow certain metabolic processes like the glucose cycle through glucose cest, chemical exchange saturation transfer, with recent work being developed at UCL on that. We're starting to get involved now in looking at hyperpolarized MRI. But what I'll be talking about, because for the sort of expertise that we have in CMIC, I think it's relevant, looking at this tissue microstructure and how we can get a signal about the structure of the tissue that we're looking at. And it also, this is probably, this is very much a hypothesis, might give us a link between the cancer heterogeneity that we're seeing from the genetics and the epigenetics to the expression of that and the shapes and sizes of structures that we can get with some of these tools. So back to neurosurgery. So the story of this goes back to the installation of an interventional MR facility, or about 10 years ago now, about the time that I moved to UCL from King's. So this is a Siemens 1.5T machine, and it shows how the surgical procedure takes place on here, and this can be rotated around on this bed, and the patient can be inserted into the scanner so we can take images during the surgical procedure. Now, when we come to the idea of tissue microstructure, again, in the lab, but in a completely different context, there was Danny Alexander, who you've heard some of the work from already today, and others such as Gary Zhang and Laura Panagiotaki. Panagiotaki, who have been developing some of this microstructure work. Now, this work has been developed within the brain, but it's now finding application in cancer. But in the brain, we're looking at how we can get accurate information on certain white matter tracts within the brain and how we can use that in surgical guidance. So this is quite a stunning example, I think. This is work done by Seb Ursulin and his group with the epilepsy surgeon, John Duncan. So this isn't cancer surgery, this is actually epilepsy surgery, but in the context of the brain, the technical issues are somewhat similar. And this is a MR image of the patient's head before surgery has commenced, and this is the one on which all the guidance is done, and which tractography and so on is done. This is an image that's taken towards the end of surgery, showing quite a removal of a reasonably large amount of brain tissue here through a skull flap here. Now, the problem for the surgeon is wanting to know precisely where that surgical excision is, that boundary, that resection site, in relation to the plan that's been acquired beforehand. And so the trick to do this was to take a non-rigid transformation and transform from this space back into this space, and that enables us to find out precisely where that resection level was in the space of the image that was acquired, the imaging that was acquired for planning purposes. And this has a real impact. These are two different cases here. This is a case where we analyzed the data in retrospect. So this is data that had been historically acquired, and they knew that the patient came out of that procedure with a 27% visual field loss. So they'd lost 27% of their sight from the procedure, which is one of the known morbidities of this procedure. And you can see why, because when we map the tractography back onto the brain, we can see that part of the optic radiation there has been cut away by the surgeon, removing that the sight of that part of the visual field. And this is a procedure that was acquired after we introduced the technology, showing that the excision has come up to but hasn't impinged upon the optic radiation. So we can get more complete resection. The surgeon can be a bit braver without running the risk of harming the patient's sight. So now onto a different part of the body, the prostate. As Mike said earlier on, this is one of the major causes of... it's the second most common cancer for the male population after lung cancer, in the Western world anyway. There is a... I'm working very closely with Mark Emberton, who's the urologist at UCH, and he's a man with somewhat of a mission to change the way that prostate cancer is detected and managed. So prostate cancer, although it is a common cause of death for the male population from cancer, the incidence of prostate cancer is much, much higher than that. So in the UK, approximately 50,000 men die of it. But when you look at the figures, above the age of about 70, and there's a few of our friends here of that sort of age, and in fact, I'm in the risk factor too, so I better be careful what I say. but there will be about 70% of men over 70 will have some evidence of prostate cancer if their prostate is investigated. If they're lucky enough to live to 100, they are bound to have prostate cancer. So it's a very, very common disease. The big challenge for all of us is to differentiate between those cancers that are likely to cause significant risk to the life of that man from those that are either going to grow very, very slowly and never cause any harm over that patient's lifetime or are just benign lesions which are left well alone. The reason for making a fuss about this is that the procedures that are currently used to operate on prostate cancer have significant morbidity. They cause major harm they can cause major harm to the men who undergo those procedures. So what we want to do, in the words of Mark, is separate the tigers from the pussycats. So we know there's prostate cancer there, but we want to find the tigers. We want to find the tigers while they're still baby tigers so that we can pick them out, remove them, maybe not completely cure the man, but delay the onset of significant disease for, say, perhaps another 20 or 30 years. So I'll describe some of the technology that we're now developing to enable that to take place. These men, rather than going straight into having needles stuck into their prostates, which rather disrupts the MR signals that we might want to take, we're getting these men pushed straight into the MR scanner, and then we undertake multi-parametric MRI. And this shows a positive case where there's a tumour just here from T2 dynamic contrast enhanced MRI, and the apparent diffusion coefficient image derived from diffusion MRI. So we bring all these together. There's a registration in that because the patient might move slightly, but key is that is the registration of that to the transrectal ultrasound that is inserted, as the name implies, transrectally. I'll leave it to your imagination how that's done. And these are sort of images that we get. There's a deformation between these this volume here and here, and that's what we wish to compensate for. We need to do this twice. We need to do it once so we can take a biopsy of the sample to see to confirm the tissue, and then we do it again for focal ablation, just to pick out the region of the prostate that is affected by the dangerous disease, leaving the rest of the prostate and surrounding anatomy intact. Now, what we're doing is also looking a bit more closely at the diffusion signal. This is simple ADC. It's been around for, I guess, 15 years, something like that. And it's a rather simple diffusion model that is used clinically these days. We're starting to introduce now a new model. This was derived by Danny Alexander and Laura Panagiotaki. I almost got it right then. Just call her Laura. They've developed this geometric model for the diffusion signal, and the way I like to think of it is you're using the proton diffusion length as like a little ruler, sort of mapping out space, fluid space within the tissue. And using the verdict model that Laura has developed, there is the ability to separate the different water-containing components of the tissue. So we have the intracellular water, the extracellular but non-vascular water, and then the water that's in the blood that's flowing. I won't go through all the mathematics, I probably wouldn't be able to explain it anyway, this just shows the results of what we've been able to do. A technique has been tested on an animal model, colorectal model, and that paper was published last year in Cancer Research. And now we're on to the clinical study with first results reported last year at ISMRM and the more latest results reported at this year's ISMRM. The key thing in prostate cancer is being able to distinguish between what they call the different Gleason grades. Now, the interesting thing about histology. So histology, these are these microscopic images. We've seen a few of those today. So they're looking at the cellular structure. There's different stains that are used that show the different cellular components, and also the stains that show up the cell nuclei, and the distribution and shape of the cell nuclei and the cellular structure has evolved very much as an empirical science over about 100 years. These were first introduced about 100 years ago when pathologists started peering down microscopes and looking at at these stained tissue slices. And so there's an empirical art on how one can distinguish disease. So the classic one for the prostate is the Gleason grading, and the key separation from the tigers, from the pussycats, is going from Gleason grade 3 to Gleason grade 4, Gleason grade 4 being the tigers. There is a change in the proliferation of the epithelial tissue. There is a change in the disorganization of the luminal structures within the prostate. The prostate is a gland, so it has a tree-like glandular structure. And there's a change in the, or a destruction or a reduction in the stromal supporting tissue. And this is shown nicely in this sort of little plot down here as we go from these three slides, manual registration of those different components, and you can see how they're changing over time. Now, the first results on human data, where we're taking multiple B-value scans of the diffusion, doing a standard fit of the single exponential from the, or single compartment from the ADC, gives us a relatively poor fit to the data, and we can see there's quite significant disagreement between the fits and the data measured. When we go to the three-component model, the fit is pretty good. Now, that doesn't mean we're getting the right answer, but we are at least explaining the information that we're acquiring. We now need to do the very accurate correlation of the biopsy samples with the signal in order to validate the information that we're getting. And that's work in progress at the moment. But back to the clinical image guidance, with the MR data that we have already, we are now, we have a clinical system where we take the MR, we generate a 3D model, we mesh that model, we assign very crude and rather approximate biomechanical properties to that, and then we allow it to deform. And the way that works is that we are simulating the deformation of the prostate with the insertion of the ultrasound probe, and just repeating that 10 or so times. And with that, we have doing principal component analysis on that model, we have a compact model which we can then fit to the slice ultrasound data that we're getting in vivo. Now we go one stage further than that, if I can get the next slide, there we go. So that's what I've just described, but now we're collecting data on hundreds of patients, and so we've now got a lot of numerical data going into the deformation fields of the prostate, and we then parameterize or dimension reducing that information to provide a system which is now fits much more effectively into the clinical workflow. We take the MR scan, there's a segmentation, that can happen quite quickly, and of course it's taken a few days before the intervention. That gives us our generative shape model, statistical shape model, and then that is fitted directly to the ultrasound data during the intervention, and that only takes a few seconds, so that we can now provide the guidance that we need. This just shows the system in process. This is just a cartoon of the 3D model fitting to the data. Here is a lesion that's been identified, and here is the ultrasound that's acquired during the intervention. And the key thing is, this slide is a bit out of date. We're now up to 150 patients that we've done on that. So it's a reasonable number of patients that we're now studying with this. This is attached to large clinical trials that Mark Emberton and colleagues are running. And the results are looking very good. So that's the story for prostate. Now I'll move on to just a few words about the breast work that we'll be doing. And again, I think this complements quite nicely what Mike described earlier on. So he's introduced the clinical problem. So ladies predominantly have X-ray mammography as the screening technique. If that is diagnosed, if either a lump is detected by the patient or a the mammogram is positive, then they might pass to MRI. The key thing about there, the lady is usually lying on her front, while in the X-ray mammogram she's standing upright with the breast compressed. So the breast, a very deformable organ, is in a very, very different shape in the two cases. And actually it's combining these different sources of information that then may give a more definitive diagnosis. And then after biopsy, then the patient, if there is a cancer detected, might go for either mastectomy or breast-conserving lumpectomy. There's an interesting story, which is somewhat similar to the prostate, about breast cancer risk and overdiagnosis, which again Mike alluded to. So we've known for many, many years that the dense breast is gives the lady a higher risk of having cancer, and it really is quite a significant increase in risk. But there is a significant concern that ladies with that breast cancer is overdiagnosed, and too many women are having quite significant procedures and also quite significant stress to them by being diagnosed with a cancer that they don't have, or at least that it's not malignant. So we're becoming interested now in using the same paradigm of using the tissue microstructure to see whether we can say something about breast cancer. We know that the increase in a mammographic density, there is a certain increase in cellularity, but a lot of it is just due to an increase in the collagen matrix of the breast. There's also some evidence that in symptomatic patients, that the peritumoral stroma, that's the connective tissue around the tumour, is stiffer in patients who have got more malignant disease. And this is just some results from Andy Evans, who is a collaborator up in Dundee, showing that stiff region of a peritumoral stroma from shear wave elastography. This is a slide I borrowed from this publication, just showing how the understanding and how the collagen matrix changes in breast cancer, in particular the alignment of collagen. It starts off as the tumour starts to grow with an alignment of the collagen, and then there's a realignment of the collagen which is causing the, or has something to do with the tumour becoming more malignant and a greater potential for becoming metastatic. Now, if you look at tissue microstructure under the slides, it's extremely complex. So this is just one patient case that the pathologists that we're working with prepared for us a few years ago. And we see here we've got where's my cursor? Ah, I've just noticed. I've been pointing here, and you haven't seen the cursor up there, have you? Is that right?
I saw
it
before, yeah.
Where's it? I don't know. Apologies for that. Somebody should have shouted. I'll go back and do the talk again with the cursor in place. who's it who gave the talk from Microsoft? I've got a little bone to pick about Microsoft. I'll use the cursor here. You must have been totally confused with what I was saying, because I thought you could see my cursor. Right, okay. So here's some DCIS here. So this is ductal carcinoma in situ. But there's various things like there's fibrosis occurring in here, there's invasive edge of the carcinoma here, and then there's some repair going on here from the a previous biopsy needle that's put in. So it's a complex process, but there is a pattern that is beginning to develop on that. So we're starting to look at that pattern. The first part of that story is to have a multimodal picture from the diagnostic imaging that we have. So we've looked at ways that we can combine the MRI with the X-ray. So the way we're doing this is by segmenting the MRI, producing from the fatty tissue and the fibroglandular tissue the X-ray projection, adding those together, so it gives us a pseudo-mammogram from the MR, and then we squish the our model of the breast until we match the mammogram. And even with a fairly crude affine model, that seems to work quite well. We've now introduced a biomechanical model, which gives us a small increase in precision, but actually, surprisingly, not a great improvement. We're also looking, and this is key for going into surgery, at how we can relate the lady lying prone in the MR scanner with a breast pendulous to lying on her back here, where the breast is in a completely different position. This is the position that's closest to the lady having surgery done. So this is much more demanding on the finite element model that we use to do that transformation. And this schematic, I won't go around it in too much detail, is an iterative way that we can run the finite element model in order to match the skin surface here here to the skin surface there, and therefore have some prediction of what's happening within the patient. And then we push that through to a surgical guidance system. We have a stereo camera here looking over the surgeon's shoulder. From that, we can take a picture of the breast marked up here and generate a 3D mesh here. And from that, match that to the 3D mesh model we have of the MR data so that we can provide some guidance. What's going on here? No, it looks like the movie isn't going to work. There it is. The movie's working. So we can get some sort of 3D guidance. Now, the key to this is an unfinished story that I'm talking about here. That we're just getting some of the components in place. One of the key components is to enable us to take the imaging data and to accurately relate it to the histology data that we have, because we're looking at the heterogeneity of the tissue, and that means we need to locate our histology samples to within something of the order of a millimetre, or at least a few millimetres, to where we are in the image. And so this is work we've been doing with Nico Kaasmaer in Nijmegen and Peter Bult, the pathologist, there. And we've got it worked through for mastectomy. So this is a mastectomy sample here. This is the image that was acquired before the patient had her mastectomy. The sample is then, this is a rather crude picture, I know, but it's this is just a standard meat slicer, a salami slicer that you can find in the butchers. And it then provides a whole series of slices. Here we see them stained, which we have photographs taken. These are all x-rayed, and these are then used to build up a 3D volume. Also, the mastectomy sample has an MR image. This x-ray 3D volume and the MR image are co-registered to line up all the different slices. And then those two volumes are related back via the modeling data that I've just described, back to the 3D MRI image that was acquired beforehand. Now, we've got that in place. We haven't fully validated yet, but having got that, that gives us a pathway back from the pathology sample, which is shown marked here, back to the preoperative image. And so we're now looking forward to collecting data, having got that pipeline in place. So the last bit of technology, have I still got time? I think I have. 5 minutes, is to talk about the motion model work that we're doing, which is the other way of compensating for the tissue deformation. And the two organs where this becomes very important is the lung, for obvious reasons. So the lung is moving during the respiratory cycle, but also the liver, which moves significantly as the diaphragm pushes up and down against the liver. Now, the classic way of doing this has been to take, and we and others have been doing this for about 5 or 6 years now, take a series of high-quality static reference images over the breathing cycle and then register those together and generate a motion model. Although the technology works, it's not very useful. And the reason it's not very useful is that patients breathe in very different ways over time. So we have a new paradigm where we can incorporate in-room, this is for radiotherapy now, in-room imaging such as cone beam CT, and simultaneously reconstruct a motion model and the static reference on the fly. And in particular, if we then relate that back to a high-quality static image that we've acquired before the intervention, then we can use the high-quality information to produce the plan, but map that onto the structure as it's moving during the respiratory cycle and during therapy. So the first paradigm is shown here, I think, quite nicely, where we have a very, very fast imaging of the... this is a vertical slice down through the lungs and liver, showing from a poor quality image how the structures are moving. This is all done in 3D. This is just a 2D slice I'm showing. And these little yellow lines here are the displacement vectors that have been computed from the registration algorithm. And then the trick here was to use that to animate a high-quality image here. So this is a high-quality breath hold image that's been animated with the deformation field that we've showed, the moving deformation field I showed on the previous slide. Now, that all sounds very nice, and it enabled us to do some quite interesting simulation of
putting ultrasound, high-intensity focused ultrasound through the abdomen to simulate how much we could increase the temperature of a liver lesion, but in practice is almost useless. And the reason is shown on this slide. These are some quite old data now showing some Cine-CT data here, three orthogonal slices through the volume, showing the animation of the structures during the breathing cycle while that patient was lying in the CT scanner. This shows just a repeat of that process. These patients were being replanned twice during a course of radiotherapy, and that enables us to see how the trajectories of different structures within the lung changed. The blue was on one occasion, the red on another occasion, and we can see not only is there different amplitude, but in some parts of the lung, even completely different directions that the lung structure was moving. And as somebody described this to me, if you've got high-focused or highly accurate radiotherapy, instead of here's the tumour moving up and down and we're going to sort of burst the radiation on like that, you're probably going to do something like this and miss the tumour every time and probably do more harm than good with that procedure. So what we're now doing, and we're working with our own team at UCH, but also the team down at Institute of Cancer Research, is looking at ways we can take the cone beam CT here, which is rotated around with it. This is the linear accelerator shown here. This is the cone beam CT, which is mounted orthogonally. All that rotates around the patient during treatment. And we get these rather fuzzy images. There's a high scatter content in there. We can reconstruct images from that. The image quality is not so good. But by doing this, let's go back one. I want is to, yeah. By doing a finer reconstruction to remove the motion to get a higher quality image, marking where the tumour is and then tracking it over the moving image, we can see here that outlines the tumour. It is there. You can just about see it, just there. But it's really hard to detect where that tumour is. But now we know where it is and we know where it is moving. And then the next step is to combine that with a high-resolution breath hold image. Here we have a breathing signal being generated down here, and it's quite uneven breathing. It comes up in a sec, that's low, gentle breathing, and then the patient does a gasp there, and you can see the corresponding movement of the lung in synchrony with that. So the next step on that, nothing's ever finished, is now to integrate that into a clinical radiotherapy system. So now to the future, we're looking at ways that we can incorporate real microscopic image into the surgical device. I haven't got a story to tell you, just show these two images just to show what the opportunities might be in the future with the fibred microendoscope. This is developed just down the road by Mauna Kea Technologies, and also very exciting work going on now in 3D photoacoustics, where this is a microvasculature of a tumour. So these are all micron-scale blood vessels, and trying to incorporate those into the interventional procedure actually gives us direct measurement of the microstructure rather than just referring to it. I always like showing this slide right at the end, and this is my saying that all this work, pushing stuff into a clinic, that's my passion, is trying to change the way that we manage patients. We have to have the healthcare providers, the hospitals, working very closely, obviously, with people like us, but a core part of this is the medtech industry. So it's only when we get this triangle working together that we can really make, in my view, an impact on healthcare. And boy, we've still got a long way to go. We saw from Mike's figures about the death rate of cancer and it increasing now as we other things we tend to be cured from. And so we have a lot of work to do. And I think that tissue microstructure is actually an interesting story to keep quite a few PhDs busy in the future. So my acknowledgement slide is here. So here's a picture of all the all those who actually did the hard work in our lab. But key people here, obviously other members of our European consortium we work with, but there's the clinicians that make it all happen, and of course the funding agencies and the industry partners that we work with. So on that, say thank you very much. Thank you.